Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, celebrating over 70 years of service to financial advisors, their clients, and institutions worldwide. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
The economy and the election today. Yes, we are still sorting it all out. It turns out trash bags really do matter. And your letters on the broadcast today as well from American Public Media. This is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the Wall Street Journal Weekend, offering four sections of ideas and information available at newsstands every Saturday. And by MassMutual, a mutual life insurance company owned by its members and policyholders. Learn more at massmutual.com/mutuality.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Thursday today, the 4th of November, and it is good to have you with us. So here's where the economy is 2 days after an election where the economy was a featured player. Retail sales are up. Worker productivity is up. Corporate earnings are up. So, too, was the stock market today. Job growth is still lousy, though. We learned this morning first-time claims for unemployment benefits were up last week. So we sent our senior business correspondent Bob Moon out to find that tipping point, the one between economic growth and new jobs.
At least the gauges show the economy keeps gaining some altitude, but at the Brookings Institution, economist Barry Bosworth says the headwinds remain substantial.
We are not headed back into a double-dip recession. That's the good news. We are going to have growth going forward, but we're not going to have growth at the rates that will cut into the levels of unemployment.
In other words, don't expect much improvement when the government reports the October jobless rate tomorrow. It'll probably remain stuck above 9%. Alan Levinson is chief economist at T. Rowe Price. He says that'll keep the lid on whatever recovery we can hope for.
We want to set our sights on a slower rate of growth than we were used to in the 1990s. Our expectations need to be restrained.
Some people refer to it as stagnation.
To Bosworth at Brookings, it sounds a lot like the kind of rut Japan has been stuck in for the better part of two decades now. Today's stronger-than-expected rise in productivity, for example, means employers are just squeezing more out of their current workers rather than hiring. But Levinson is more optimistic.
I wouldn't use the term stagnation even to describe where we are now. I would say that we have an impaired recovery, slower growth than we should be having after such a deep recession, but that the economy is moving forward, doing the things that it typically does to heal itself and gain momentum in an expansion.
Bosworth worries consumers and businesses will get so used to the stuck economy that they stop doing the things needed to promote growth, taking the risk to expand the company, for example, or summoning up the courage to make that big purchase. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
Bob didn't mention the housing market in that piece, but it's still out there, hanging on. We've talked quite a bit about the foreclosure mess, from robo-signers to misplaced documents, and federal investigators have been looking into it. But the states have done most of the heavy lifting. Last month, attorneys general from all 50 states agreed on a joint investigation into the banks and their paperwork habits. But things have changed since then. Marketplace's Stacey Vanek-Smith has more now on how a new political landscape might affect the case against the banks.
Attorneys general have been leading the investigation into the foreclosure scandal. The GOP picked up 5 AG positions earlier this week, and that could complicate things, says Dave Cohen, a professor of political science at the University of Akron.
Frankly, I think it'll make it harder. Democrats tend to be much more consumer-friendly. Republicans are more connected with Wall Street and corporate America.
The Democratic attorney general in Ohio was one of the people leading the investigation. His Republican replacement hasn't taken a position on the issue. And if this investigation is going to go anywhere, it needs to happen quickly, says Georgetown law professor Adam Levitin.
My sense is if the attorneys general can move fast, it will turn into something. If this turns into a drawn-out investigation, you know, the banks will settle for, they'll pay a couple hundred million, and that'll, it's like flicking a penny at someone for them.
Still, Democratic Attorney General Tom Miller of Iowa isn't worried about the GOP's political gains. He's leading the foreclosure investigation, and he says the effort has been bipartisan so far, partly because the attorneys general aren't looking to hit banks with huge fines. Rather, they're looking to make banks help fix the problem.
One of the things we are concerned about here is that the servicers aren't adequately funding the modification process. Rather than paying a huge amount of fines, it might be better to put the money into fully funding the modification process.
About 450,000 loans have been modified nationwide. More than 6 million homes are in foreclosure. In New York, I'm Stacey Vanek-Smith for Marketplace.
There have been strikes all over Europe for months now protesting austerity budgets. One of the common concerns has been the various proposals to raise the retirement age in certain countries. France was basically shut down for a week and a half, you might remember, over a bump from 60 to 62 years old. This week, the British government said it's pushing its retirement age from 65 to 66, 6 years earlier than it had planned to do that. It's going to save the government more than $8 billion in the process. So how much do you suppose we could save if we pushed up our retirement age? Marketplace's Elisa Roth has that story.
Americans can retire with full benefits at 66. Raising the retirement age would save money, but it takes a while.
Most of the costs of benefits paid out by Social Security today and in the near future are for people who are already in the system.
Andrew Biggs is a former Social Security official.
Increasing the retirement age would have no effect on benefits for people who are currently retired.
For example, a little more than 2 million people will retire this year. Altogether, 53 million people draw Social Security. This year, the government will pay out more than $700 billion in Social Security benefits, and that figure is likely to rise. Biggs calculates even if you raise the retirement age to 70, the savings after two decades would only be around $30 billion a year, which is a small piece of the total. Biggs and others agree that even if we raise the retirement age, Social Security's budget will come up short as baby boomers retire. Generous estimates say the extra savings would cover only about a third of the projected budget gap. Jeff Brown is a finance professor at the University of Illinois. He says it makes sense to raise the retirement age, but there need to be other measures too.
More importantly, from an economic standpoint, is for us to try to figure out how to get people to actually stay engaged in the workforce longer.
In any case, we are raising the retirement age. In 1983, the government decided to increase it from 65 to 67. The change didn't start until 2000, and it won't be fully in place for another decade. In New York, I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, happy, nothing but. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. If you've taken out the kitchen trash lately, you may have considered the color of your garbage bags. Or you may not have. I mean, who cares what color your trash bag is, really? Well, the folks at Hefty sure do. They're launching a new product next year, hoping consumers are vested in the color of the bag they carry to the curb. And that color is black. After we read the story today in Ad Age, we called Hefty to ask them why they're doing this, but they weren't available. So we've called Kit Yarrow. She teaches consumer behavior at Golden Gate University in San Francisco. Kit, good to talk to you.
You too, Kai.
So listen, do you care about the color of your trash bag?
I actually kind of do.
Come on. Seriously?
I wouldn't spend more for a different color trash bag, but I got to say, if there's a variety to choose from, I might go for the black.
Well, so Hefty's tagline on this thing is keeping garbage in the dark. What might the appeal be?
Well, you know, people do have issues with their garbage. There's a lot of shame and waste. You know, it's untouchable, it's full of odor, and a lot of revelations about what you've invited into your home. Plus, a new layer of shame around environmental issues. So, I think people do want to keep it in the dark. But mostly, I think people are going to be attracted to those trash bags because they match a lot of the new decor in kitchens today.
Yeah, so I saw that the whole stainless steel appliances versus the white appliances. So now black looks better with stainless steel. Is that the deal?
Yeah, and apparently even garbage looks better in black.
Do you think Hefty's going to be able to convince people to make this switch? I mean, they're risking a whole product line on this.
You know, when you buy a trash bag, you're literally buying something to throw out. So given that, I don't think people are going to get really wiggy about garbage bags. They're not going to, I think, ever rise to the challenge of making this a big, huge, conscious decision. I think trash bags are always going to be fairly rote purchase. They're going to be driven by price and familiarity above everything else. That said, this is something completely different. So maybe there'll be a little more consciousness in the minds of consumers around what they're buying. It probably will give them an advantage, although I think not a huge one.
So here we are. We finally come full circle. We're talking trash bag marketing on Marketplace. Kit Yarrow teaches consumer psychology at Golden Gate University up in San Francisco. Kit, thank you so much.
My pleasure, Kai. Thank you.
We report with some regularity on the most watched indicator of overall economic health in this country, gross domestic product, it's called. But the sum total of everything tangible that an economy produces isn't necessarily the be-all and end-all measurement of economic health. Today, the United Nations released its latest Human Development Index. It tracks well-being across the globe. And the United States is getting a demotion. Our special correspondent David Brancaccio reports that we are getting dinged for economic inequality.
It's been 20 years since the UN used new statistics to acknowledge that there is more to well-being than just money. The UN's Human Development Index looks at income in countries around the world, but it also looks at measures of health and education. On the very first of these rankings, back in 1980, America was number one. Today, UN officials reveal that the U.S. is number four for well-being, behind Norway, Australia, and New Zealand. And for the first time, the rankings were also filtered for inequality, gaps between rich and poor. Jenny Klugman, the director of the UN's Human Development Report, explains what happens to the U.S. when this gap is factored in.
Its overall Human Development Index falls by about 11%, which is quite significant. It's much more than, for example, Australia. When we adjust for other developed countries, the normal loss is much less.
With inequality considered, the U.S. ranking for well-being drops from 4th to 13th in the world. Tamara Drought tracks U.S. income inequality at the think tank Demos. She sees the U.N. finding as part of a long arc.
The middle class has lost ground, and lower-income households have just been clobbered. That is the story of the last couple decades.
America's rank in the Human Development Index was, on the other hand, helped by its record on education, since the index rewards countries where people spend the most years in school. In New York, I'm David Brancaccio for Marketplace.
More of David's coverage and our series Economy 4.0 on our website. It tracks a whole set of alternative indicators like the Human Development Index. It's at marketplace.org. Coming up, how do you save a city?
These homes have been deteriorated to the point where you have nothing to do but to tear them down.
Detroit looks at downsizing, but first, let's do the numbers. Yes, a little dose of the Fed's medicine went a long way on Wall Street today. The Dow Industrial soared 219 points. That's a hair under 2%, closed at 11,434. The NASDAQ up 37 points, nearly 1.5%, 2577 at the bell. The S&P 500 up 23 points, 1.9%, ended things at 1221. Wall Street hasn't been this high, by the by, since Lehman Brothers went under, oh, so many years ago. Financial stocks climbed across the board. JPMorgan Chase led the charge, rising 5.5%. Bank of America banked 5.3% today. Commodity stocks continued their streak, and retail companies joined the party. Gap racked up 6% gain today. Bonds rose according to the Fed's plan. The yield on the 10-year T-note was pushed down to 2.49%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by T. Rowe Price, understanding the connections of a complex global economy. T. Rowe Price, invest with confidence at TRoePrice.com. By Gather.com, the social network where people can make new friends who share their interests. People talking about today's news at news.gather.com. And by Vanguard, whose mission is to simplify investing and to help people reach their financial goals at vanguard.com/public radio. If you missed the broadcast, you can still catch Marketplace. Go to our website and click on Podcasts. You'll also find our new podcasts, The Midday Update, Freakonomics, and The Tech Report, all at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Friday. In Washington, the Labor Department reports on unemployment for October. The National Association of Realtors releases its September pending home sales index, and President Obama leaves for a 10-day overseas trip. He'll spend some time in India, Indonesia, South Korea, and Japan. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl.
I'm going to sit right down and write myself a letter.
It has been a busy week. We had elections, a big Fed meeting, and the foreclosure crisis, as we talked about earlier, is still going on. Aaron Hayes of Rockville, Maryland, is tired of hearing about how bad homeowners have it.
During the housing market boom and bust, I was living on $18,000 a year, and I couldn't afford a house. So instead, I lived in a tiny apartment with a bunch of roommates so that I could afford to sock away a little bit of money each month to invest in my retirement.
Rick Asom from Presque Isle, Maine, points out that there are opportunities perhaps to be had with all those foreclosed homes.
Whatever happened to the entrepreneurial spirit? They have housing units. We have a growing number of working homeless people. Fix the gutters, paint the houses, rent them. Banks could help neighborhoods, help the economy, and protect their investments.
I talked to fashion editor Kate Betts the other day. We were talking about how the economy is putting the rugged back in men's clothing. Feedback was mostly positive until Jessica Ostrower weighed in from San Clemente, California.
This reflects such a simplistic and problematic concept of what it means to be a man and consequently manly. And Betts' comments about models being, quote, more beefy and American looking were equally problematic.
Also in fashion news, my comment about fan favorite Mondo Guerra's loss on Project Runway struck a nerve. Mary Ruth Shields teaches fashion at Lincoln College of New England in Connecticut. Her take is that Mondo getting the boot represents a sellout, she says, to the forces that think the consumer either doesn't know any better or wants to look like everyone else. So there. And finally, an apology to Aselda Thompson from The Woodlands, Texas. Much as I complained a couple of weeks ago about my local All Things Considered host ruining a baseball playoff game for me by giving the score before I had a chance to watch it on TiVo at home later that evening. So I apparently did the same thing for Aselda and Project Runway. So, Aselda, mea culpa, won't happen again. If you have comments, fashionable or otherwise, send them our way. Our website is marketplace.org. Click on that link that says contact. There's probably no American city that has become more of an icon of the recession and the very jobless recovery we're having than Detroit, Michigan. It's been that way for years, actually, since before we ever heard the words financial crisis or automaker bailout. Detroit has lost more than half its population in the past 50 years. Industries have left, and Mayor Dave Bing says the city can't support people who live in some of the emptier parts of town. So he's got a solution. Tear down as many of the 60,000 vacant buildings in Detroit as he possibly can. Ask residents in less populated neighborhoods to move closer to the center of town. And in essence, redefine what it means to be Detroit. Dave Bing, it's good to have you with us.
Thank you so very much. Good being here.
Just to be clear here, Mr. Mayor, you aren't talking about knocking down some of these 60,000 vacant buildings and convincing people to move away from their homes to other areas of town to consolidate and make Detroit a denser, more urban place to live and so help it survive that way.
Because we've lost such a large portion of our population, people have just left. And, you know, these homes have been deteriorated to the point where you have nothing to do but to tear them down. So we're going to do about at the tune of about 3,000 a year over my term, or 10,000 for the term. But there are also a lot of homes that can be rehabbed. And then we've got to rebuild.
I think I read a quote of yours someplace talking about how you're going to go about this. And you said, you know, we could bulldoze 3,000 buildings a year for 10 or 15 years and still have leftover capacity. I mean, it's the scale of the problem is enormous.
It is huge. I don't think there's another major urban city in this country that's dealing with what we're dealing with, because we have lost almost half of our population over the last 30 or 40 years. And Detroit had always been a high middle class community based on the industry that was here, and people were working, making good wages. That has changed dramatically. So in order for our city to come back, we've got to take care of those that are still here and create the right kind of environment so that we can hopefully get middle class people to move back into the city.
Where is the money going to come from to do this? Because, knocking down houses and consolidating population and instituting new services doesn't come cheap.
Well, I think in the short term, we are going to get some support from the federal government. But we've got to be very smart with the money that we get from the federal government because it's not always going to be there. So we've got to invest money smartly. We've got to figure out once again how to make this an exciting city so that people who are here want to stay here and people who are looking for an urban environment and an urban experience here in the city of Detroit, they can get it here.
About that federal money, the Secretary of Housing and Urban Development and the Secretary of Transportation have both said they support what you're doing. There will be federal monies coming. But how do you convince them that Detroit ought to get that money when there are so many other cities in Michigan, Flint and Pontiac and others, that need help as well? Why Detroit?
You can't turn your back on the city of Detroit. Detroit is the largest city in the state of Michigan from a population standpoint, from a landmass standpoint. And it says something to the rest of the world. If Detroit fails, then not only does Michigan fail, but I think there are a lot of major cities around the country that could really fall into this.
This entire proposal, I imagine, is somewhat daunting, but there must be one aspect of it, one part of it that just keeps you up at night.
Oh, no doubt about it, is when I got to face the people in neighborhoods that we can no longer support. That's tough because you've had maybe three or four generations of a family living in a particular neighborhood, community, block, and the last thing that they want to do is move.
If this works, it is no doubt a major achievement. If it doesn't, though, what happens to the city of Detroit?
Well, I don't think in a negative term it's going to work. It may be in different degrees, but it's going to work. And it's not going to happen overnight. And that's the thing that people have to understand.
Dave Bing, he's the mayor of the city of Detroit. Mr. Mayor, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you so very much.
Our Shanghai correspondent, Rob Schmitz, has been out and about lately. Yesterday, he took us to Inner Mongolia, China's northern plains, and their seemingly endless rolling hills of grass. Underneath those hills, though, lies 20% of the country's coal, a third of its natural gas. And that has turned Inner Mongolia into the energy source for China's booming economy. And it has forced locals to give up everything they know about farming and raising livestock to try their hand at new fossil fuel-based economies. Here's Rob.
Big blue trucks filled with black boulders race each other out of a coal mine. This region is the largest coal basin in China, and these trucks are barreling down the highway to Beijing. A couple of months ago, a two-week-long traffic jam outside the capital city was caused by trucks from these mines. Urban China's hunger for coal energy has made this region rich overnight. Some here have tapped into this new wealth. Others are just left bewildered. A motorcycle is one of the only things 57-year-old Meng Ke has left. He used to have hundreds of sheep and cows, but he had to sell all of them. The government is forcing him and the rest of his village off their land. It's part of a policy that aims to undo decades of environmental damage from overgrazing. My land is worthless anyway, he says. It's all turned to desert. Workers put the finishing touches on Meng's new home. The government gave him an apartment the size of a garage in the nearby city of Wushanqi. This in exchange for his family's 300 acres of farmland. He's here to check on progress. Once construction's finished, he'll have something else to think about.
Now the problem is a job. People like me in their 50s and 60s, we need jobs too. The government should think it over. If the government can solve this problem, I think people will be happy living in these apartments.
There are plenty of jobs in this region. The nearby city of Ordos has the highest per capita GDP in China, thanks to the region's abundance of fossil fuels. But these jobs require specialized skills in mining, financial services, or real estate development, says Iqbat Togochog. He runs an organization seeking more freedom for ethnic Mongolians in China.
I'm not really optimistic about their future because most of the Mongolian herders who lived in the rural area, they do not have the skills to survive in cities, Chinese cities.
But that doesn't mean some won't try. 40-year-old Wuda Bala harvests corn by hand at her farm. She hasn't moved to the city. The city moved to her. The government built a four-lane highway in her front yard this summer. Her neighbors were forced to move, but she was spared. So she dusted off a few old yurts the family had in storage, put them up in her front yard, and is now the proud owner of a Mongolian-themed roadside diner.
Once the road was built, there were so many out-of-towners driving by in luxury cars, I thought this type of business might do well. They come here, eat mutton, some cheese, drink sheep's milk, and learn a little about Mongolian culture.
Wu now makes three times what she made herding sheep. But building a roadside attraction isn't the answer for everyone. Pan Zhaodong is an economist at the Inner Mongolia Academy of Social Sciences.
We need to create a more diversified economy here with more jobs. Everyone should share in this region's rapid development. It shouldn't be channeled to the richest minority. That'll just make the wealth gap here worse.
And it'll hurt people like Meng Ke, the herder who's been forced off his land. Standing by his unfinished government apartment, Meng isn't sure what to think of his new life. All he's ever known is herding animals, and that's all gone now.
It would be nice if someday the government here could set aside a piece of land for old herders like me, so we could raise some cattle and plant some grains. But I haven't heard what their plans will be for us.
This is, says Meng, what the government calls social development. But what's next for him, he says, looking at his new apartment, he doesn't know. Reporting from Inner Mongolia, China, I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
You can see how the landscape, both economic and actual, is changing for those herders, and also what a roadside diner made of old yurts looks like. Anyway, it's on our website, marketplace.org.
Marketplace is supported by Reputation Defender, protecting online privacy by monitoring the web and removing your personal data from websites that sell it. ReputationDefender.com. By Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act. And by Putnam Investments, dedicated to helping financial advisors and their clients pursue a more comfortable retirement. You can get the latest at RothIRAblog.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, following up on our story about the Human Development Index that David Brancaccio did for us and how the U.S. is slipping, the World Bank came out with its own survey today on how business-friendly various countries are. The most improved? Kazakhstan. Yes, that Kazakhstan. Seems being an authoritarian regime is conducive to starting a business, obtaining construction permits, and protecting investors, or so that survey says. The U.S., by the way, number 5, behind Singapore, Hong Kong, New Zealand, and the United Kingdom. And that is it for us today. That's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow closed up 219 points, a hair under 2%. The NASDAQ up 37 points, 1.5%. The S&P 500 added 23 points, just under 2%. Ben Adair, John Buckley, Stephen Gregory, John Haas, Jonathan Karp, Doug Krisner, Betsy Streisand, and Lisa Tucker are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is George Judson. You can tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. And back here on the big show tomorrow, art and the Haitian recovery.
Art is a way of saying, you know, this is not all we are, being poor, being desperate, as we're often seen.
I'm Kai Rizdal. I do hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media. The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.